Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday. That means it's the wrap-up show of the week, and that also means it's an expert counsel Q&A show. I got a great lineup, including some folks you haven't heard from in quite a while. I do need more questions for the expert counsel, so please send them to me. Easy, easy, easy to do. Send an email to me. I have the most public email on planet Earth, and I have one email, really do. I don't have a screener. It is, of course, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com. I give you, I didn't know if it was your real email. Yeah, it's my real email. It's been public for 18 years. It's my real email. It all goes into one box. Send an email there. But if you want to make sure I see it, because a lot does come in, and I know it's for the show, TSPC in the subject line for general stuff with the show, with experts, TSPC space expert in the subject line. Give me your, say, my questions for expert council member, fill in the blank. Don't put fill in the blank. We don't have a fill or a blank, okay? Fill in the blank. My question is, one sentence, question mark. Yeah, you can do it, promise you. If you have more than one question, I have two questions. My first question is, my second question is, you can do that. I'll let it go. Next, then hit the return key a couple times and tell us all the details you think we need. And if you do that, you're going to really get a really great answer from one of these great folks. If you're like, hey, well, who are all the people? There's a lot of them, and I don't catch every show. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, and a sub-tab under the About tab will be Meet the Expert Council. And guess what you can do there? Meet the Expert Council. So who do we have today? Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini will ask a simple and try to answer a simple question. Why does Trump constantly lie about Thomas Massie? I'll give you my opinion on that. I haven't listened to them yet, so I don't know what their answer is. But I'll tell you what I agree with, what I don't agree with, and what I really think drives this irrational behavior the man has. Next up, Antonio Gatto, who we have not heard from in a while, and I do need questions for him. He does stuff on real estate and home improvement handyman type stuff, right? So he's got all of that in one. He's going to talk today about if you are going to become a landlord, how do you screen your tenants so that you don't end up making one of the biggest mistakes of your life? Because a bad tenant can ruin everything, especially when you have a single or only a couple rental properties and you can destroy your cash flow for a very long period of time and put everything at risk. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about how to cook the humble squirrel like a chef. I've cooked a few squirrels in my life. The person specifically asked about red squirrels, but you pretty much cook them all the same. The only issue with red squirrels is they're smaller, so you get less meat off them. Jean Pugliano will talk about what the hell happened in the silver market over the past few months. Jean sent this to me last week. I didn't get it on the air last week, though. I bet he would have preferred if I played this before the big giant correction. But we'll see. I guess I'm going to be listening to these with you as we go today. Joel Riles will talk about protective gear for your doggos, like dog boots and dog goggles and dog ear protection, dog flotation vests, why you might want stuff like that. Mike Molina will answer a question about buying a high-end 9mm handgun, something in the $1,500 to $2,000 range, and why you might want to do that and what you would consider if you did. I've got some thoughts on that one, too, but it really isn't about the guns themselves. It's about a single statement Mike made that's not always true. And it ain't about any particular model. It's about why someone shot better. And I'm gonna go back to like something I heard from some like business leadership speaker back like 30 years ago. I can't even tell you who it was or what it was directly about. But I think it applies here. One of those weird brain cells you dig up after decades and it's still valuable to you. And then I'm going to talk to you about a Bitcoin question. Why did it crash? Shut up. I mean, I've given the same advice for 12 years. You think it's going to change? No. But this is a question that is going to bite some people a little bit. It really is if you're looking to sell some Bitcoin. I'm just saying. And it's basically, how do you know which Bitcoin you're selling for tax purposes? And sadly, the answer for many is you don't. You don't. And so we'll talk about what the current rules say about paying tax on Bitcoin that you sell and some other issues that come into this. With that, let us go ahead What are we going to do now? Oh, I'll tell you what we're going to do now. We are going to go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Chris Rossini on why Trump constantly lies about Thomas Massie, who probably, if not definitely, is the best person that we have in the United States Congress. And I'm talking the House and the Senate both there. Let's go ahead and hear what they have to say on that, and I'll give you my addition.
Well, one of the reasons we're bringing this up today, and we even sort of hesitate to give this a more air than it deserves, but unfortunately President Trump has been leading the charge. There's no secret, we've talked about it before, has been leading the charge against Thomas Massie. He's also been, just frankly, let's just say it, he's been lying about Thomas Massie and his record, and we'll prove that later on in today's program. But the thing that happened differently, and he's done it once before, is doing something that I consider unspeakable, which is making fun of Thomas Massie's personal life, attacking his personal life, the fact that he's remarried now, that his wife passed away, and he's doing it in such an unacceptable way. Let's put this first clip up. I struggle to not say something stronger, but he put out a few days ago, people are saying that Thomas Massie became a liberal because his new wife, blessed be their marriage, is supposedly a radical left flamethrower. This new union all went so fast that maybe he didn't know what he was getting into. But nevertheless, he's an absolutely terrible and unreliable Republican, perhaps a rhino, or maybe even worse. Ed Gallarain, a farmer and war hero, is running against Massie. He's a man of high quality, blah, blah, blah. He's running because he realizes Massie has been totally disloyal to the president and to the Republican Party. He never votes for us. He always goes with the Democrats. Thomas Massie is a complete and total disaster. We must make sure he loses big. Now, we both have had experience with Thomas Massie's current wife. We've worked with her, not directly. Well, you have directly. But let's leave it to our good friend Tom Woods, who put something up. It's on today's LouRockwell.com, where he answered some of this. If we can put that next clip up. Because Tom knows very well what's going on. Now, this is Tom Woods on today's LouRockwell.com. Tom says, it's hard to know where to start here. Number one, Thomas Massie has the most conservative voting record in the entire Congress. So he is not a liberal, especially in the sense that Trump means. Number two, Massie's wife, the former Carolyn Maffa, is no radical left flamethrower. Whoever led the president told the president that is out of his mind. I first got to know Carolyn 15 years ago when she was working for Campaign for Liberty, the organization Ron Paul founded after his first GOP presidential campaign. At Dr. Paul's request, I wrote the statement of principles for that organization, and you can be assured there was nothing left-wing about it. Now go to the next one. Here's Tom Wood still commenting on this. None of this applies to Carolyn. So to subject her to this is deranged. Especially because the worst of the sycophants just echo what the president says. I can't tell you how many people really think that Massie votes with the Democrats most of the time. And we are speechless, and they are speechless when I explain to them that Trump is well to the left of Massie on pretty much everything that separates them. Number three, in fact, and you said this before, Dr. Paul, in your intro, Massie votes with Trump 91% of the time, and the other 9% are when major promises are being broken. Now, we've talked about it on the show before. I've known Carolyn when she used to come over and visit. When we were working for you on Capitol Hill, she was working for Senator Paul, a well-known radical left flamethrower, right? I mean, it's just so preposterous. It's insane. And it's really, it's demeaning to the office.
You know, I never want to rush to judgment and not know exactly what he said. So I thought... You should look it over because it might have been a typo. And after you went through all that and looking at what Tom Woods has put on, I think I don't know what the word would be, but it ain't typo. Well, I don't know. It's so strange.
Yeah.
It's so strange. You know, I guess. I would describe it, I'm trying to get as soft as possible, it's uncontrolled meanness.
Yeah.
It's just being mean.
This war Trump has with Massey, I'm going to explain where I think it comes from in a minute, and it's from Trump being a petty little bitch, basically. But it falls under one of those things that you just look at as someone who realizes that the orange man's done a whole lot of good at the same time he's a fucking idiot. And you go, why? All you have to do here, bro, is nothing. But your ego's too big to let you do nothing. And here's the core of it. Trump, to his own detriment, values loyalty so much that it clouds his ability to be rational and pragmatic. I think it's very important to value loyalty, and getting somebody to vote with you over 90% of the time is pretty fucking loyal in the world of politics in Washington, and that should be enough. But that's not what he means. When he says loyalty, he means kiss the ring loyalty. No matter what, you can even disagree with me, I'll hear what you have to say, but once I've made the decision, you fall in line with it. That's what Trump means. And that's fine as a C-level officer in a company when the other people work for you. It's not fine in politics with a co-equal branch of government. You see how that works? That doesn't work that way. So this is all about ego. And the ego is even worse because Trump's gone against Massey in primaries twice and lost bigly, in Trump's own words. Not about what happened, but that's one of Trump's words, right? Bigly. He lost bigly. Like, and it's going to happen again. Massey is going to win the primary again by a long shot. The people of Kentucky know what they're getting from him. But that's what this is. This is petty bullshit. It also has to do with the Epstein files. And it's not because Epstein files show that Trump is a pedo. In fact, for all the mentions, Trump's mentioned in there. Shut up. Right? Mentioned what? Accused by retards that when it's followed up on, nothing's found. Mentioned because he's president of the United States. Mentioned because he's a known associate. I've said this before. The files is retarded in an investigation this large. If someone comes to my neighborhood right now and unalives one of my neighbors, the sheriff's department would be the lead investigative authority out here, and I guarantee a sheriff's deputy would come to my house, ask to speak to me, and very briefly and to the point, I would honor that request, and anything beyond, hey, did you, no, I didn't see anything, no, I don't know, or I saw a car, whatever, anything beyond that, okay, if you want me to speak to you further, I will have an attorney present, but I'm still happy to talk to you with an attorney present, because that's what smart people do. All right, and then if there was ever a big giant hootie-doo over that investigation, you could verify and claim Jack Spierko is in the dead neighbor's files. That doesn't mean I had anything to do with it. But here's the issue with this. This is a huge stinking can of worms, and there are people that could be revealed in those files because there's some of the shit that's in there that is so disgusting. And you're supposed to redact the victims, but they redact the person that did it. And those motherfucking people need to go into a wood chipper. They need to go into a wood chipper, is what they need to do. But they won't give us... But there are also shitloads of names in there that have nothing to do with this freaking sex trafficking bullshit. Okay? Nothing. But now their name... And I think that Trump and many other people in government not only want to protect the people that actually need protecting, because they want to also protect the people that didn't actually do anything. Jeffrey Epstein was a billionaire that ran in billionaire circles with lots of people that would be like high-level millionaires, high-net-worth people, etc., all in that orbit. And over all those years of him being allowed to get away with what he got away with, there's a whole lot of people that are associated with him that are not associated with his actions. You know, there's a picture of me and Glenn Beck with our arms around each other. We met each other exactly one arm around, you know, like guys do take pictures. That doesn't mean that I'm buddies with Glenn Beck. That doesn't mean that we hang out. It doesn't mean I can tell you anything about his personal life. It just means there's a picture of me with him. And I think there is a mixture of a willingness to cover up for scum in here, and also a desire to protect people that get through. Well, he was mentioned in there. He was mentioned in there. And then there's people now like, so-and-so was never mentioned in there. And? That doesn't mean they're not a shitbag. It doesn't mean they're not a sleazebag. It just means they weren't involved in this as far as you know. So I think all of that together makes Massey a thorn in the side of the Orange Man. And instead of doing the smart thing, which would be make a phone call or two and say, hey, man, look, mostly we're on the same side here. What can we do together? Or just shut up. He can't do it. His ego is so big. And I don't know what the word is. It's like he a person with a giant ego that also has an extremely fragile ego. That's Trump in a nutshell. He is so full of himself that he can't hear anything against what he says or he stands for without feeling personally vehemently attacked. It is a huge character flaw, and it will prevent a lot of his legacy from being what it could be. He could be so much more effective if he would work with people like Massey in these situations and learn how to work with people that you otherwise don't get along with when things align. But he can't do it. His ego's too fucking big. In other words, I don't know the word for it, but a big fucking baby. I mean, that's what it comes down to, and it's really sad. Next up, let's hear from Antonio Gatto on how not to be sad about who you rent a property to.
Hello, TSP community. This is Antonio Gatto coming to you again from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where I'm always happy to answer all of your questions pertaining to home improvements and real estate. Today's question comes in from audience member Kevin. Kevin writes in, hello, Antonio. The time has come for me where I just finished renovating a single family home that I bought approximately a year and a half ago, and I'm now ready to start showing it to potential prospects for leasing. I am new to real estate and landlording, and I was wondering if you could provide me with some tips and guidance on how to properly screen for tenants. I really want to avoid renting to the wrong people, as I've heard many horror stories about having bad tenants and the nightmare that it can potentially turn into. Since I'm new, I have a feeling there may be some areas of knowledge that I need introduced to and the proper way to go about this. I would greatly appreciate any guidance you could provide in helping me get the ball rolling. Thank you in advance, and I appreciate your time, Kevin. Kevin, thank you very much for sending in that question, and that is a crucial question, especially for somebody like you that is brand new to real estate and landlording. And it's very, very important that you follow the procedures that I'm going to give you today to really help minimize the chances of you getting bad tenants and getting burned. Unfortunately, so many landlords, they don't go through all of these steps, and they're usually the ones that you hear that do get burned and have a very negative experience. So I do have to say, though, before we get started, congratulations on your very first flip. I know how exciting that can be. I know a lot of sweat equity and elbow grease went into that, so it's a very exciting time for you. I remember those days well, so congratulations to you. So great. So you have a single family home, and you are ready to lease it. So what's the first thing that you need to do? The first thing that you have to do is you have to simply list it. So where is a good place to do that? So I am a very big fan of Zillow. I always use Zillow, and I always suggest that to others. If you go onto the Zillow website, you will find on there what is called the Zillow Rental Manager. Now, this is free for you to use as a landlord. You get all of the criminal background checks. You get the credit checks. You get the verification. Everything you need as far as landlording goes is on there. Now, there is a $35 fee that the potential tenants will have to pay for, but that is only when it comes time to them for them to fill out a formal application, and that is after they get past all of the screening steps that we're going to be talking about today. And one quick reminder, it is very, very important, just as if you are going to be selling a house, make sure that you have very high quality photos of the property that really showcase all of its features. Make sure the curb appeal is top notch, the yard is manicured, grass is cut, sidewalks are edged, driveways are pressure washed, it's neat, clean, add some flowers if you want. All of that makes a very big difference in making it much more enticing for foot traffic through there, and it gives you the opportunity to get top dollar for your rental as well too. So you have it listed, and you get an email saying that somebody is interested in your property. Great. So what you do next is you go into your message folder and you reply to them and you tell them, thank you very much for your interest. Before I actually show the property, though, I do need to speak with you over the phone as I have some questions for you. What time is good for you? And you give them two options. Whenever they agree to one of those two options on time, this is where you have to pay very close attention. If you tell them Thursday at 5 o'clock, and they call at exactly Thursday at 5 o'clock, wonderful, then you can proceed. If they do not call then, and you get a text message 20 minutes later or half an hour later from them saying, hey, this is so-and-so, I'm just reaching out to you regarding the property at such and such address, that's all you need to know that that will not be a good tenant. Number one, you did not ask them to text you. You asked them to call you because you wanted to have a conversation on the phone. And secondly, they were late and they did not even let you know that they were going to be late. So that's somebody that you want to certainly move on from. So if you do get somebody that calls you at the agreed upon time, wonderful. The very first question that you have to ask them, number one, is, so why are you moving? So you want to keep your ears open for any complainers. If somebody is telling you, well, I'm moving because I don't like my landlord, I'm not getting along with the neighbors, the people that I'm living with, we don't get along. If you hear a lot of complaints and negativity, this is a person you certainly want to ignore. If they give you legitimate reasons such as, well, we're just looking to upgrade. We are looking for a bigger space as my husband and I just had a baby. We're looking for a better school district. My husband's job, we just got relocated. Those are all great reasons and very valid reasons. So if you get reasons like that, feel free to proceed along. Second question is, who will be living at the property? Is it just you? Is it you and your husband, you or your wife? Is it a group of college kids? You need to make a decision as a landlord and understand how many people are you comfortable with having in that house. The third question is, how long will you stay? Another decision you have to make is, are you okay with a 6-month lease or are you good with a year lease or longer? I personally use a 1-year lease because it's fair for everybody. And within that 1-year time period, it really gives you the opportunity to develop a good solid business relationship with your tenants. And it's a good gauge to figure out if you want to move forward with them, if they are potentially long-term tenants, which hopefully that they are. If they are not, they don't meet your expectations, you do not have to renew the lease at the end, and then you can relist it. Now, the fourth question is, do you have any pets? Now, this is another topic that you really need to think about hard. I have a lot of friends that are landlords, and they have no pet policies. I do not have a no pet policy. I do permit pets, but I do have a pet limit, and that is 2. Now, the reason for that is when you get into 3, 4, 5 pets, there's much more of a chance of there to be occurrences of accidents in the house. If they have cats, if the cat sprays, those smells can be pungent. If the dogs, unfortunately, you urinate on the floor and you have hardwood floors, it can get messy is basically what I'm saying. So I believe in a pet limit, -2. So that's something that you have to take into consideration too while you're asking that question. The fifth question is where do you work and how long have you worked there? If you get somebody telling you that every 3 months they had a new job, 6 months ago I worked here, 3 months ago I worked at this different company, that tells me that that person might be very, very flighty, and it sounds like they may be irresponsible at the same time. What you want to look for is somebody that has a good, solid track record in an industry that has been employed for a while and has a good timeline to back that up as well, too. And the final question is, when are you looking to move? So I don't like to sign any lease agreements that are any more than 3 months out from the current date. And the reason for that is because it can be a drag if it goes on longer than that. And quite frankly, that's 3 months of rent that you are losing as well, too. On average, it's usually 1 to 2 months. And the reason for that is because that gives the person just enough time to pack things up and move. It could also be that their lease is expiring next month and they're trying to line up a place. So if you find a good tenant and it's within 2 to 3 months of you signing the lease agreement, I have no problem with that. So the next step, if you get past all of those questions and you like what you hear and they meet your criteria, the next step obviously is to show the property. Now, this is very, very important what I'm going to tell you. If there are 3 or 4 people on the lease agreement potentially, and there are 3 or 4 people that are interested, it is very important that you meet every single person that is going to be living there. If it's a group of 4 people that are going to be living in the house and only 2 show up, make sure you are very clear and tell them, I will happily show you the house today, but I do need to meet the other 2 people before we proceed any further. Now, there's a reason for that. you are going to be entering a business relationship with them. There could be a reason that they are not there, that they are not letting on. They could be undesirable in some way. They might not have the best history, etc. So just be very, very careful about that. And it's something that I always tell people not to overlook, and definitely meet everybody. And the same goes with the pets as well, too, in particular dogs. You want to meet the pets before you sign a lease agreement, because you need to know, are the pets friendly? Are they well trained? And are they loud? Are they barkers? I cannot tell you how many times in the past I've showed properties to people. The moment they get out of the car with their dog, the dog starts barking and it doesn't stop for the entire time. Unfortunately, that's not a match, because the number one complaint of rental property is noise violations. So you definitely need to be aware of that. So you take them inside and you show them the property, you walk around, they like it. When you're finished showing them the property, now this last section here is very, very important. Once you show them the property, then you tell them, say, well, I just showed you the place, so I'm going to give you folks some time to yourself to walk around and talk amongst yourselves. I'll be outside. Come on outside when you're finished. Now, this is what I want you to do when you go outside. When you go outside, you walk up to their car and you look inside their car. And I do not mean to open up their car door and go through their belongings. You just glance inside and you pay attention at what you see. If you look inside that car and you see candy wrappers everywhere, bottles, crumbs, clothes piled everywhere, I have news for you. That is exactly what your house is going to look like. If you look inside the car is perfectly vacuumed. It's neat. It's orderly, clean, polished. That's exactly what your house is going to look like. There is a very strong correlation with how a person keeps their vehicle and how their house is on the inside. So remember that. I use that tip and trick every single time, and it has never let me down. Trust me on that one. So the next step, if you get past all of that and you like what you see, the next step is to fill out a formal application through Zillow. And at that point, you need to make a decision. They're moving forward. Now, there are so many other steps moving forward that we do need to talk about. It's too much for one segment today. So if I can answer any questions regarding lease agreements, regarding rules and regulations, get those questions over to Jack and he will send them to me. And I do want to say one final thing in closing here. Do not be a desperate landlord. Trust me when I tell you an empty house is better than a bad tenant. Remember that. Be patient. Wait for the right people to come. It is always well worth the wait. They are out there. There are plenty of good renters out there. I hope everybody's year is off to a great start, and we will catch you on the next episode. As always, stay safe and never stop learning. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, I'm going to point out just real quick here that real estate is always worth considering. And the younger you are, the more true that is. It is the number one way by which people have become multimillionaires in the country. And it is one of the few assets that you can reliably buy with other people's money and generate cash flow from, a significant amount of which, and sometimes all of which, is non-taxable. But the thing that will blow it to dog shit is bad tenants. And specifically bad tenants in certain cities and states where tenants have undue protections regardless of how poorly they act as a tenant, as in paying their rent on time and not fucking shit up inside your house, okay? So the advice you just got there can make you a millionaire and prevent you from blowing multimillion dollar opportunities at the same time. And we do, again, need more questions for Antonio. He's the newest member of the council. He came on after the fall workshop, right in the middle of the holiday season. I told him today, keep sending me content so that people get to know you. But if you want to know more about real estate investing, things like that, or anything a handyman would handle with home improvement and things like that, think of this guy as like your real estate advisor and a replacement for Tim the Toolman Cook, who used to be on our council. Think about it that way. All right, next up, let's talk about something I know a little bit about, cooking a squirrel. Let's see what Chef Ken has to say on this.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Jerry, who asks, can you recommend some recipes and prepping steps for squirrel? Smoked, barbecue, fried, crockpot, sous vide, jerky, maybe squirrel burger? Jerry, this question sent me down a road I honestly hadn't walked in a long time. I hadn't cooked squirrel in forever, and not because I don't respect it, but because, like a lot of ingredients that live outside the mainstream, it slipped into the category of, I'll come back to it later. When your question came in, I realized that later had arrived. So I went and got squirrel and what's available to me here in Texas, and I cooked it again. Same prep, same animal, old school braise versus sous vide. And what I found wasn't shocking, but it was definitive. Before we get started, we need to talk about what squirrel actually is, because misunderstanding the meat is where most people go wrong. Squirrel lives its entire life moving, running, climbing, stopping, launching again. That builds dense muscle fibers and almost no internal fat. None. And this tells you immediately this isn't a meat you can be aggressive with heat with. It doesn't behave like chicken. It doesn't forgive impatience. And if you treat it like something it isn't, it will dry out immediately. So prep matters. So skinning with the tail step skinning method keeps things clean and efficient. And if you don't know how to do this, there's plenty of demonstrations on YouTube University. Once skinned and gutted, a brief rinse, a good pat dry, and then into the fridge loosely wrapped for about 3 to 4 days, maybe sometimes a week. That rest matters. Fresh squirrel is tight, almost spring-loaded. Giving it time lets the muscle relax so it doesn't fight you later. Now let's slow down from here. This is where most people miss something important. Depending on the size, pull the back straps. They're small, and that's exactly why people ignore them. But do not ignore these pieces of meat. And if you've pulled back straps from deer, it's the same idea, just smaller. Pull them cleanly, tenderize them lightly, take a small mallet and lightly pound your meat, not smashing them, just evening the thickness and opening the grain. I dredge them just like fried chicken. Hot pan, butter, maybe a little garlic, thyme, paprika. Pull them when they're golden brown, and those back straps are delicious. These are worth the effort, and unlike some of the more tough parts of the squirrel, this is something you can enjoy the same day you process it. Everything else on the squirrel tells you a different story, though. Legs, shoulders, ribs, that's all working muscle, loaded with connective tissue. And that's exactly why braising became the time-honored condition. Not because it was rustic, but because people lacked options. Low and slow heat breaks down connective tissue. So classic squirrel stew is the clearest example of this logic. Brown the squirrel gently in fat, add onion, garlic, maybe bay leaf, black pepper. Cover it with liquid and let it simmer low, not boil. Towards the end of the cook, add in some root vegetables, and it's perfect for these colder days of the year. Every region has their own cultural influence on this dish, so ask around. Usually somebody older that probably has some dirt under their nails is probably a good place to start. So that's where I started again, a proper braise, and it worked. It always does. There's something nostalgic about this technique. The flavor was exactly what I remembered. It was deep, it was honest, and it was unmistakably squirrel. Then I tried something else. So after revisiting the braise, I sous vide the next batch. And I'll say it plainly, sous vide won. Not on nostalgia, not on tradition, but on control. Squirrel doesn't fail because of flavor. It fails because of moisture loss and timing. Braising fixes that by surrounding the meat with liquid, but it also gives you a narrower window before the meat crosses from tough to tender into mush. Sous vide gives you precision, and with a meat this lean, precision matters. The window that worked consistently was mid-150s, around 155 to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, held long enough for the connective tissues to soften without collapsing the muscle. 12 to 18 hours for legs and shoulders was where the sweet spot for me was. Lower than that, and things didn't quite relax, and higher than that, the texture started to lose its integrity. Fat in the bag is non-negotiable. Butter worked well for me. Squirrel doesn't bring fat to the table, so you have to bring the fat. That fat protects the meat and carries aroma without masking flavor. When the cook is finished, the squirrel goes straight into an ice bath. No pause. This step locks the texture exactly where you want it. After that, dry the meat thoroughly and let the surface reset. Moisture is the enemy of browning, and that drying step is what makes every finishing technique actually work. So, from there, Jerry, your entire list finally behaves the way you want it to. Frying becomes about texture and not doneness now. You moderate the heat, season with flour, shallow pan of fat. You're building crust. You're not cooking the meat through because you've already cooked it in the sous vide. So based on the timing, I try to give you techniques over recipe. So if you need a recipe on how to throw some rabbit and some flour and fry, just let me know. Moving on. Now, smoking finally makes sense. Raw squirrel dries out before it ever tastes like smoke. Sous vide squirrel doesn't. You keep the smoke gentle and short. Apple or cherry wood works beautifully here, giving sweetness without overpowering the meat. Hickory can work, but use sparingly. Barbecue follows the same logic. Traditionally, squirrel was simmered first, then sauced and finished. Sous vide replaces the simmer with better control. I would sauce late indirect heat with a very short finish. You're looking for a glazing of your meat and a slight char from the grill. Burgers, yes, but never pure squirrel meat. Historically, squirrel was always blended with fattier meat. A mix of about 50% squirrel balanced with about 50% pork shoulder, and maybe some added pork fat. Seasoning matters, though, and squirrel prefers restraint. Thyme, bay, sage, garlic, onion, black pepper. All this fits. What it doesn't want is sugar, heavy rubs, or super aggressive spice blends. And finally, bones. Squirrel bones are small and easy to miss. The smart move is to deal with them after tenderizing and cooking, not before. Once cooked, the meat releases cleanly, and you can pull it apart by hand, freeing from anything that doesn't belong. This includes the peppering of buckshot. Take time to remove all this, and your guests will thank you. So, Jerry, the honest takeaway is this. Squirrel has always been braised because it has worked for hundreds of years. Sous vide does the same thing, just with more precision. Thanks for your question. Remember, keep those questions coming in. Find me at bloodsugarchef.com. And until next time, this is Chef Ken, your Blood Sugar Chef. Cheers.
So I'm just going to give you a few more things. There's nothing wrong with anything you just got there. Number one, though, squirrels tend to have about 2 litters a season. They'll have one in late winter. They'll rear those up to where they're weaned, and then they'll tend to have a second litter in the summer going into fall. And so most people are going to be shooting squirrels. Some states actually have almost no real season. You can shoot them whenever you want. Some have a spring season on squirrels as well, but most states have small game season, and squirrels will be part of that sometime in like October and November-ish, maybe late September, depends on where you live. And that means that you basically have 3 categories of squirrel up in that tree that you could be bringing to the ground with the lettucillin. You have very young, small squirrel. You have a young of year squirrel. In other words, that squirrel was born this year, but he'll be kind of a medium body size. You have an old squirrel. It could be a year, 2, 3, 4 years old. The ones that were both born this year, there ain't that much of a difference. A squirrel that makes it all the way through a winter and back around to the next fall is going to be a lot tougher. And I don't know how to explain what to look for, but if you hunt squirrels regularly, you're going to be like, that one was born a few months ago, that one is, you know, born this year, and that one is older. And you just know. And when you go to skin them and you feel the difference in the way the sinew holds, it verifies it for you. So just going to say that. Next, person asked about red squirrel. They're all the same. I always preferred shooting gray squirrels, though, because a full-grown gray squirrel is almost twice the size of a full-grown red squirrel. Red squirrels are pretty small. But if that's what you got, that's what you got. Everything will work for that. Now some methods of cooking. Specifically, when you have a young of year, some squirrel that was born the last year or less, a really simple method is you simply skin the squirrel and then quarter it. And I don't mean quarter the way we do a deer completely, where it's all broken down and actually more than quarters. I mean literally like right where the backstrap joins the ribs, right where you go kind of like on a, if it was a cow, you go from your ribeye to your New York strip, cut it in half, and then split the backbone with both the front and the back end. So it's in 4 pieces, so it's truly a quarter. And then season them however you like. I like to use kind of like a steak-type seasoning. Get a grill ripping hot. And when I say ripping hot, I mean ripping hot. I mean, you're afraid that if you touch that grill top for a half a second, it's going to brand you hot. Put that squirrel with some, brush it with some olive oil or another fat like butter, anything that'll give it a little bit of fat to help it not stick, and that seasoning. Sear both sides of it. Just to the point where it's got marks on it, just so it develops a flavor. Put it in heavy-duty foil with a little bit of chicken stock and some other fat. Butter works great for this, or olive oil. Seal that foil, and when I say seal it, I mean where you like fold it over and double roll it, and then the sides come up, and maybe it's like you want it to puff up like a pouch and let almost nothing out. So it almost gets a little steam pressure. Move that foil pouch to the indirect heat side of the grill, turn your heat temperature down, close the lid, and let it go for about 30 minutes. As simple as that is, it will blow. Everybody I've ever done it from is like, oh my God, this is good. And it's true. It's delicious. You can also simply do a buttermilk marinade like you're making fried chicken, bread it, and chicken fry it, and it's delicious that way, again, with your younger animals. When you get an animal and you go, this is more than a year old, especially when you're like, this one's been around a while. This is grandpa squirrel. This is grandma squirrel. This is a three-year-old squirrel, let's say. Those are always put in a different bag, and I labeled them stew squirrels. I did bone squirrel, like take all the meat off all the bones before, and I ended up deciding it wasn't worth the effort, but I do like the idea of the loins and doing them separate and all that, if you want to go that far. Squirrels, the stew ones, I did the same thing. Bust them into quarters, vacuum seal them, put them in the freezer, and I would save up to where I'd had about 4 to 6 squirrels at least and make stew. And I've made 2 different kinds of stew out of squirrel, and I've done kind of like, call it a brown stew and more like a red stew. So think like an Irish, like if you were doing like an Irish lamb stew, the way you would take that, making your roux and your gravy and how you'd simmer that, go that way. Or more of like an Italian stew where you're bringing in herbs like rosemary and thyme and oregano, and you're bringing in some tomato and do a mirepoix and cook that down. And I've done both directions, and it's fantastic. So it's not do that instead of what Ken did. Those are other things you can do with it. And those were like my primary things I did when I was a kid. And I mean, when I say I ate a lot of squirrel, in average season, between me and my dad, we would probably process between 50 and 70 squirrels a season. And that's a lot of squirrel for you know, a family of 4. That's a lot of squirrel, especially when not everybody eats it. And so I've eaten a lot of it. And I've never done this, but my gut is, you know, like a little bit of a dry brine with some salt and some orange peel, not with the pith, where you just zest it, so you get the orange zest and some thyme and a little bit of black pepper and let that sit overnight in the refrigerator. And then to do a confit with that, I think that would come out effing amazing. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. But Ken is right. It's easy to dry out if you overcook it, but it can be cooked for a long time if you cook it with the right technique. Anyway, it's probably more than you needed added on to that. It's just, I like me some squirrel. I'm just going to say it. Next up, let's talk about the silver market with John Pugliano.
Well, hey, TSP, we have a updated question from Jake. He's asked about silver before. You know, with all that's going on and with silver getting way above $100 an ounce, I'm going to, as best as I can, drill down, hit the high points. This is literally something that we could talk about all week, you know, let alone in a, you know, few minute segment. The other thing to consider, though, in this particular situation and any time you have some historical issue like this that's going on, it is extremely complex. You know, people want to try and simplify everything. And people always want to, you know, like picking out Bible verses, twist and contort the context to suit your own agenda. But know that this is a very complex situation, and it just isn't one or two things that's driving the price of silver. But from a high level, what are they? Well, bottom line is we are in at least some semblance of a commodity super cycle because, you know, it's just not silver. Look what's happened to the price of virtually all the metals. And most commodities, I mean, whether you're talking gold, silver, copper, cobalt, uranium, I mean, just about everything but oil is at or near record highs. And a lot of this, not all of it, again, because this is very complex, but a lot of it has to do with the building of data centers, everything that's going on with artificial intelligence, and the expected demand in the future, the near future. And that means increased electrification of virtually everything. And not only because of data centers, but also specific to the United States, the reindustrialization that's going on that, you know, we've been talking about for a long time. All these things require more energy, and things like silver that are very efficient at conducting energy are critical components. Beyond that, and to make matters worse, China has recently been clamping down on their export restrictions of industrial grade silver. And keep in mind, China is the number 2 exporter of silver. They are the number 1 refiner of silver, and they are also the number 1 consumer of silver. And so this is kind of like another rare earth magnet moment with China, where they're trying to throw their weight around and deny other countries access to silver because China wants to dominate industries like, you know, electric vehicles, solar panels, and other such products that consume a lot of silver, and they want to keep their price advantage by restricting raw material availability. Now, moving away from just pure industrial utilization, silver is really having its moment in the sun because it's really a catch-up trade. What I mean by that is silver has drastically lagged behind and underperformed gold. And I'm not talking just, you know, recently. I mean going back the last 20, 30 or more years. But it has caught up and surpassed to where now the silver-gold ratio is somewhere in, say, the mid-40s. I think the record is in the 30s. So we're close to about as expensive as silver gets in comparison to gold. And to put that in perspective, from probably about, I don't know, the 1990s through most of this century, that ratio was in the 60 to 80 range. But just as recently as last year, it had spiked up to 120 times, right? Meaning that gold was 120 times more expensive per ounce than silver. So again, this is a catch-up trade because silver's been neglected for so long. And along those same lines, I mean, we're talking about industrial utilization, but consider investing in jewelry. You know, a country like India has a very strong cultural admiration for gold as an investment, and they do it in the form of jewelry. Well, gold has gotten so, you know, out of price in the last couple years, and like I say, a 120 ratio last year, that many people in India have been forced to substitute silver for gold. And their demand is off the charts. So that's something that this past year has really pushed up the demand for jewelry-grade investable silver in India. Something else to think about in the price of gold as we've gotten up, you know, to and above $100 an ounce, and this is where the large number distortion comes into play. When silver moved from, say, $20 an ounce to $30 an ounce, it was a $10 move. A lot of people didn't notice it, but that was a 50% increase in price. Now, and you know, recently in past months, as it moves from 70 to 80, 80 to 90, 90 to 100, it happens more rapidly. People start getting excited by those, you know, psychological $10 increments. But really, $90 to $100 is like 10%. This rapid movement in the price, it just causes people to have more emotional reaction to it. It spurs FOMO, fear of missing out, and really all the speculators jump in because they see the volatility. Okay, a couple other things here just in terms of the cause of the price of silver moving up so much. And these last two I'm going to sum up as Trump derangement syndrome. So that takes us to the safe haven factor of silver, which, you know, again, traditionally it's been gold. Silver has been in the shadows, but as gold has gotten so much more expensive, people are flocking to silver as a safe haven asset. This has a lot to do with two major factors, and that's geopolitical instability and fear about the strength of the U.S. dollar. And, you know, we've got maybe another government shutdown coming, and so that's pushing people over the edge. And then Trump talks about Greenland, and you have a lot of our trading allies cozying up now back to the Chinese. Listen, this is the way I look at it, and I don't have time to explain it, but neither geopolitical instability nor U.S. dollar weakness concern me at all, and I think it's a ruse in terms of both gold and silver's price increases. And when it comes to dollar weakness, yes, the dollar's down some 10% since Trump's been president. Number one, he actually is constructing it that way. His tariffs have gone up something like in the neighborhood of 17% on average. Well, a weaker dollar is a stealth tariff. So if you do want to create a better environment for U.S. manufactured products, then between the tariffs and the 10% decrease in the dollar, he's effectively now made foreign products at least 27% more expensive. The U.S. economy is not suffering. The Atlanta Fed, whose numbers are always questionable, but right now they're forecasting fourth quarter real GDP could be as high as 5.4%. Let that number sink in. What's going on with silver right now is, I think, more than anything, between being driven by the commodity super cycle and the export restrictions from China, this more than anything reminds me of the Arab oil embargo of 1973. That's when we saw oil prices spike to well over four times what they had been, and it really shaped the geopolitical landscape for the next 50 years. We could be seeing this now as far as jumping in and getting fear of missing out on silver prices. Hey, for me, I'd be avoiding it. When you get parabolic moves like this, no one knows where the top is, and historically, you see a 70 to 90% pullback. I don't know if it'll happen this time. It could be different, but I see so many other opportunities within the overall industrial supply chain of the reindustrialization of the United States that I'd be investing there rather than focusing on one commodity. Hey, I went long, and I just covered the high points. I'm sure Jack has something to add. Thanks for the question. Until next time, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealthsteading Podcast.
So really do not blow past the weaker dollar comments toward the end there. Not only is Trump's plan to weaken the dollar, that is the only plan there is at this point. The illusion that there was ever a way to rein in spending, and I told you this almost 20 years ago now, but I think now that we've had Doge and Trump 2.0 and exposure of all the graft and all and how little all that grift is compared to the total cost of running the government. And we can't cut fucking any of it without the world ending. We can't cut any of it without the world ending. So if you get into a position where you owe a trillion, you know, trillions of dollars, almost $40 trillion now, and you can't cut spending, it's impossible to do. The world will end if you don't spend, right? The world will end if we don't spend. That sounds like a t-shirt. A very sad t-shirt, by the way. Then the only thing you can do is devalue the dollars that you are forced to pay back. And when you're trying to move from an import country to an export country, well, this country must do that. There is no survival mechanism for this country at this point other than for us to begin to produce in surplus domestically again in a thousand different ways. The Orange Man has that part right. But this is the more important thing to understand. Everybody knows it. I don't care what they say. I don't care who gets elected. I don't care what they promise. This is the plan, which means the value of things like silver and gold, other durable commodities, Bitcoin, etc., will long-term go up nonstop for the foreseeable future. I want to say forever, but forever is a long fucking time. Forever in the span of a human lifetime for a middle-aged person? Yeah. Yeah. Forever, as far as you're concerned. You'll be dead before it stops. So the play is easy. The other side of this, and it's part of this gold-silver ratio thing John was talking about, is what's called an inelastic demand for silver. In other words, if you have an iPad or an iPhone or a nice, you know, GPU-intensive computer that you use or a MacBook or a million other electronic devices, there's a small amount of silver in there, okay? And that silver is such that the amount and how it's in there is not economically viable for recovery. In other words, it's not worth taking apart a 20-year-old computer to get the little bit of silver that's in there out of there. It's cheaper to buy it, it's cheaper to mine it, it's cheaper to refine it, and you could increase the price of silver tenfold, and that'll still be the case. And you still, what do you think Apple's going to do if they have to spend, you know, instead of $4 worth of silver in an iPad, they have to put $20 worth of silver in an iPad, not make the iPad? Or do you think he's going to raise the price of the iPad to account for the silver they have to put in the iPad? That's inelastic. There's medical devices that use silver. There's so many more things that use silver industrially, and almost none of it is recoverable than use gold. And that creates that what's known as an inelastic demand, meaning that as pressure is put, you have to start thinking of silver more as a rare earth element than a precious metal in some ways to understand this. It's both, But if you think of it more of a rare earth, I need it to build these things. Then, since I only need a little bit of it, if the price goes up, I'm just going to pay for it. That is a big part of what's driving. And then China trying to pinch off and control. You see, when you put it in the rare earth category, it starts to make more sense. Just like they try to control lithium. And if I can drive the cost up and I'm the supplier, then I benefit. So I think all of that played into this. But the devaluation of our money is the number one reason. And then there's retardism, right? Or I got a new term. Instead of retarded, when it's even worse than retarded, it's subtarded. Like, you didn't even meet the already extremely low standards of being a retard. Now you are a subtard. And subtardism is, oh, it just went up 100%. I better buy some. And so all the retail that piles into buying at the edge of one of these cycles on the upside not only drives the price higher than it ever should have went, it drives the fall harder than it should have ever happened, because those are the people that come in right at the end that put in a couple $1,000 and then freak out like the world is ending and sell it all at a loss so it didn't go to zero. So there you go. That's the other side of it. Now let's hear about dog safety equipment, like dog protective gear, PPO, or PPE for dogs.
Hello, everyone. This is Joel with Fortress Canine and Canine Academy coming back at you with another expert counsel segment. And today I wanted to talk with you about dog protective gear. So it's getting in the middle of winter time. If you like to take your dog out on hikes, if you track with your dog, if you do any kind of like extensive outdoor activities with your dog, you may want to consider having some protective gear for your dog. So I wanted to talk about what that would entail and the brands that I recommend if you're going to do that type of thing. So if you have a dog that is either being walked around on blacktop pavement frequently, especially during the summertime or during this time of year, if you have a dog that is sensitive to snow, you may want to get some kind of dog boots for your dog. Now, what typically happens when a dog walks is they put their paw on the ground and the pads on their feet spread apart. And then when they spread apart, they have the weight on their foot. And then as they pick their foot up, their pads come together. And then when they step down, their pads spread apart again. This is normally just a natural way that a dog walks. But if a dog is walking in snow, what will often happen is when their pads spread apart, that snow gets between their pads. And a lot of dogs don't like that. Now, if you expose a dog to walking in the snow a lot, this may not be an issue. None of my dogs have issues walking around in snow. They like playing in it and all that kind of stuff. A lot of dogs do. But if your dog is sensitive to snow, it's typically because it's getting the snow grains between its pads. Also, if you're going to be walking a long way in snow, like let's say you're going to go hiking, and you're going for a couple of miles and there's snow. Snow can be very abrasive. A lot of your sled dog teams and stuff like that are required to wear dog mitts, various different kinds, because the snow can be so abrasive, it will actually start to bleed. It'll rub their pads until they start to bleed. All right. So if you're doing any kind of extensive activity where you're walking on snow or where you're on hot pavement, dog boots are great. I really like the brand Rough Wear, and I'm putting links to all of these brands and my recommendations. I'm sending them to Jack so we can put them in the write-up for this. So you can check those out. They're available on Amazon. You do need to measure your dog's paws for these. They sell them in pairs because oftentimes a dog's front paws are slightly different size than their back paws. And you want to fit the front paws together and the back paws together. And then I generally try to write on them or make some kind of a mark on them so I can remember which are the front and which are the back. But Rough Wear is my favorite brand for this. They actually have a Vibram sole on them. They're very durable, and I really like the way they attach. One mention on those is make sure when you put them on, you have to train your dog to be comfortable walking in these. The first time you put them on, they're going to kind of be all clumpy and like, whoa, what's these things on my feet? And I just walk the dog around. If they start to try and mess with them with their mouth, I tell them, leave it alone. And after a couple of days of walking around in them, they're like, oh, okay, these things are kind of cool. But when you put them on, make sure there's a little Velcro tab. You kind of pull it tight at the top of the boot, and you wrap it around the dog, and then it Velcros to itself. Make sure that's nice and snug, especially if you're going to be walking through deep snow, because if they come off in deep snow, you're probably not going to find them again. and if they're nice and snug, then they won't move around. The other thing is, if you fit them too big, they will sometimes flip, and the actual part that's supposed to be against the ground will be on the top, and the other part will be on the bottom. So when you measure them, make sure you measure them as accurately as you can. The next thing is, if you're out again in snow and there's a lot of sun and reflection going on, dogs can experience the same kind of snow blindness that we can. And so I like to have some kind of a tinted goggle that I can put on the dogs. And my favorite brand of dog goggle, if you're just going with a goggle, is Rex Specs. Again, there's a link to this in the show notes description. They have sizes of Rex Specs that will fit everything from very small dogs. I put them on my puppies sometimes for pictures, all the way up to Great Danes. They have a huge size selection. They have different colors you can choose from, different tints on the lenses you can choose from, and you can swap the lenses out. Really cool company. Their product is very secure on the dog's head if you fit it properly. Again, there's a little bit of a training process to get them to comfortably walk around in it and not try and paw at it and stuff like that. But they are really great for eye protection. If you're doing anything where there's high winds, they're riding in a sidecar of a motorcycle, they're in a convertible vehicle with you, they are in a place where it's windy and sandy or windy and snowy, right? And there's things that can blow in their face. Or if they're tracking and they're pushing through thick brush and briars and things like that, eye protection can be really important. My recommended brand for that is Rex Specs. Also, if you're a person that wants your dog to be able to be around gunfire and you're going to shoot guns around your dog or any kind of other really loud noises that can damage their hearing, dog's hearing can be damaged just like our hearing can be. You're going to want some kind of ear protection for the dogs. And if you're sticking in this kind of a realm and you're not going to go full tacti-cool and get the canine helmet and all the cool stuff that we make for that, my favorite brand for that is also Rex Specs. And I have a link for that down there for you, too. This is kind of like a neoprene sleeve with foam in it, or like a spandex sleeve with foam in it. And you slip it over the dog's head. And it's actually designed to go along with their Rex Specs goggles if you want to use them together. So if you have flying brass and stuff like that, it doesn't get in their eyes. And they're designed to fit together on the dog if you want to wear them both. Or you could do just the hearing protection or just the goggles. So that would be a time that you may want to use hearing protection for your dog. And then the last one is, if you're going to be out and about in the wintertime, you're going to be hiking or doing things like that where your dog could possibly get wet. Wet and cold do not go together. They don't go together well for people, and they don't go well together for dogs. So my favorite kind of a vest or a harness for a dog in this particular situation is a neoprene type of a harness. They often use these on retrieving dogs when they're jumping into cold water. They're swimming out, retrieving ducks, and coming back, and then they're going to be sitting in a blind for long periods of time. The nice thing about neoprene is it's kind of like a wetsuit. And if you've never worn a wetsuit, what happens in a wetsuit is you put the wetsuit on, you get in the water, and you actually you pull the neck of the wetsuit back, you dip it into the water, and you intentionally let cold water get inside the wetsuit. And what happens within a few minutes, when you first do that, it's like, oh, that's cold. But within a few minutes, your body temperature warms that water up, and it's like a very thin layer of water on the inside of the wetsuit, warms that water up, and it keeps you nice and warm inside. So the neoprene suits will do that for the dogs. They'll keep them warm. They'll have some level of keeping them dry. They also have some flotation to them that will help the dog swim if they're going to be in situations where they may need to swim. And so they're a really great all around, keep the dog warm, help them if they have to swim. And if they're just pushing through snow and stuff like that, it'll help keep the snow from getting in their fur and melting and getting them wet. It'll stay on the outside in that particular situation and help with the dog's warmth. So those are the four dog equipment items that I would recommend for winter time if you're going to be moving outside a lot with your dog, going on hikes and fun stuff like that. And so I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want more information on how to train your dog, check out Canine Academy. Go to thesurvivalpodcast.com. Click on the Canine Academy banner. Check out our options there. We have a basics, intermediate, and advanced course. You can read the descriptions and figure out which one of those best fits your needs for your dog. And if you're interested in a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. One side note on that is we do train other types of dogs as well. We have companion dogs and service dogs, depending on what it is you're actually looking for. So if you don't need a protection dog, but you need some other kind of trained dog, if we have dogs that match what you need and the training that you need is something that we can do without completely interrupting our typical training schedules, we really try to work with our clients that have those types of needs as well. So if you're interested in that, check out fortresscanine.com, click on the consult form, send me a message, or you can text me at 813-836-9244. I hope this has been helpful for you. And remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
I guess my only add on this is any equipment that you plan on putting on your dog that the dog is going to wear, start putting it on them as early as possible. Whenever I take Belle out in public, she's the dog I got from Joel. She's not a certified service dog. She wears a service dog vest because it makes people not come up and get in her face and potentially get bit because they're stupid. And I just don't want people thinking they can walk up on my dog. And it also, like, even where dogs are allowed to go if they're not service dogs, it reduces the amount of, why is the dog here? You know, like, employees that even though their place allows dogs still have to interject, like, well, what's your dog doing here? As soon as they see the service dog vest, that just all goes away. So I put that on her from the day I got her. I asked Joel, like, what would be the best vest to buy? He gave me some advice. I picked one. And I'll give you on putting vests on dogs, the easiest way to do it. Make a habit of, like, petting your dog's face and all and, like, grabbing their nose. Like, when I say their nose, like, your whole snout. Like, you're holding your mouth shut and doing it playfully and petting and being nice so that they don't take offense to that. So, like, they, like, oh, that's just fun. And sometimes it's play and sometimes you're just checking me out. And, like, anything like paws, ears, anything you have to inspect, do that same thing with. But once you have that down, then you take your arm and you put it through the neck hole of the dog vest, and you have the vest hanging on your arm, almost like you're wearing it. The bottom is unconnected, but the head hole is around your bicep, let's say. And you pet the dog, and you grab the dog's nose with the hand that's got the vest on it. Then you take your other hand, and you slide it right over their head. And so all equipment should be like that. Shoes, if they're going to wear dog boots or whatever, the earlier you start doing it, the more accustomed. Put it on, leave it on for a few minutes, and take it off. Put it on, take it off. Put it on, take it. It just becomes a thing. And they don't worry about it. They don't freak out about it then. The only thing I've ever really used with my dogs from an equipment standpoint, now I'm not doing some of the operational shit Joel is, but here's an example of where you might want to do this even if you're not doing that. We used to do a lot of hunting with dogs. Like I talked earlier about hunting squirrels. We hunted squirrels and grouse and rabbits and pheasants and all kinds of stuff. And a lot of times those dogs would have to go into some pretty rough bush. And sometimes they'd have things like sand spurs and stuff. And you get a dog coming out and he's got a sand spur in his foot. That's not very nice. And I thought to myself, well, I wouldn't want this. So what I used for my dogs back then, they make dog boots that have little holes in them for the claws to come through. And they're basically leather. And they kind of look like a moccasin or something. And then they have laces. And they lace around the dog's ankle. And when I first put the first dog I ever had, I put these almost a Brittany Spaniel. He did not care for it at first. But once he got accustomed to it, he was a much happier dog in the bush with those on. And it also got, like, another thing you can do with equipment is make it associated with enjoyable activities for the dog. So Britt real quickly came to the concept of, when I get my dog boots on, we're going to the woods. So we might be hunting, or we might just, so that was the other thing. I would put the boots on when we were just taking a walk, when we're doing some scouting, or if we're doing some training where we're not really hunting. So the boots became, instead of an annoyance, oh, when the human puts the boots on my feet and we get in the truck goes to the woods and I get to hunt. And so just some add-on to, like, how to make the dog more comfortable with some of this stuff. Start young, do it a lot, take it on, put it off, and make it associated with enjoyable activities. And the vest, I'm telling you, I know he mentioned a water, flotation vest, that's good and all for that stuff, but just if you're going to be out in public with your dogs, the number one thing I can suggest is a vest and a patch, like Velcro patch that goes on there. It says, do not pet, I'm working. Even if you're going to let people pet your dogs, it creates that first stage of stay off. And then know this, some people are still stupid. And they'll run right up and get in your dog's grill. And I immediately correct and I put my body between that person and say, excuse me, what is wrong with you? And that's exactly how I phrase it. Excuse me, what is wrong with you? Did you think that the dog's patch and his vest didn't apply to you? Were you special or something? Oh, I'm sorry. And I have no talk. Like, a lot of times if somebody will ask, if the dog seems open to it, I'll let them. You know? But when a person does that, there's no negotiation. You get away from my animal. You're not smart enough to be around my animal. Just my addition. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead. I think I got one more for you on high-end 9mm from Mike Melito from Good Shepherd Training.
What is going on, TSP? Michael here to answer your gun-related questions. I got one today on high-end 9mm. So that's what we're going to talk about. His idea of a high-end, it's a pretty good definition. He says $1,500 to $2,200. Now I'm going to relate this to cars. 90% of the time, will a Ford Focus or whatever your plain vanilla car is do everything you need it to do? Yeah, it will. Is a fancy sports car, a McLaren, a Maserati, is it 10 times better? Or several times better? No, but it is better. If you're wise and you're just buying something because it's shiny, yeah, the higher end guns are better. This guy, to expand a little bit, I'm going to paraphrase, he says for years he shot a Glock, thought it was just, that was as good as it got. Then he shot one of his buddy's really nice high-end guns, and he shot much better with it. Yeah, because it's a better gun. But you have the basics down, and you're getting fairly good, fairly decent. The shooter is the most important thing, but yeah, a better gun will help you shoot better. Better trigger, better sights, better power-to-weight ratio. Better ergonomics, right? These things do help. So let me start off with my number one pick, because it's my go-to carry gun, fighting handgun. I generally carry a full-size fighting handgun, and that would be a SIG 226 single-action-only Legion. It's a metal-on-metal gun. It's hammer-fired, has a superb trigger. The SIG 226 is legendary as far as reliability and ruggedness goes. If there is any gun that rivals Glock in that category, it's the SIG 226. And that family. I like a single action only. I like a 1911 style gun. I like cocked and locked, thumb safety. That's just me. You may not. But that SIG Legion, and then also the SIG Zev. I'm blessed to have one of those. A little bit more. It's a little bit racier. It's a fantastic gun as well. Both of those are going to be in that price range, that $1,500 to $2,200. And that's what I have and carry most, so that's what I'm going to recommend. It would seem kind of disingenuous for me to recommend otherwise. Now, I mentioned 1911s already, and you mentioned target shooting. I don't think there's anything wrong, call me crazy, with a 9mm 1911. Now, I like a 45 1911. I really do. They're fantastic guns, and they're very shootable for the size and weight they are. But guess what? When you chamber one in 9mm, fantastic. I'm going to tell you to stick with Colt. I'll tell you if you want a nice, and all the Colts are nice, but if you want a nice version of this that's in your price range, the Colt Gold Cup. The Colt Gold Cup is like the creme de la creme for target shooting. It'd still be fine for carry. National match barrel, target sights, all the wonderful 1911 ergonomics. They still make them. They made them for decades, which, you know, bodes well for that. Much like the SIG 226, something that's been made like that for decades. Fantastic. A Colt Gold Cup in 9mm would be a fantastic choice. Now, I also really like 2011s. I carried those on duty for quite a while. STI, now Staccato, they make a fantastic, fantastic double stack 2011. Like a double stack 9mm 1911. They're fantastic guns. They're a little bit out of that price range, but you look around, you might be able to find one used in that price range. There's a lot of cheaper clones of Staccatos, and they're just that. They're cheaper clones. Of the ones that I know, I want some cheap Turk nasty, made in Turkey clone of an actual good gun. I want the good gun. You hunt around for a good one. And I've been running 2011s for a long time, but they became the hotness the last 2 or 3 years. Like, everybody wanted one, which tells me nowadays there'll probably be quite a few on the used market. So keep your eyes open. Really, any that you like, I can't think of a bad model that they've ever made. Another one you may want to look at, the SIG P210. It was like the original legendary SIG handgun as far as like the cream of the crop, like an upscale, really nice, and maybe the first crossover competition target 9mm and duty 9mm. To switch to use these as a duty gun, and they're renowned for their target shooting capability. They're also a really good design, the SIG P210, and they still make them. They make the new one. They make a full-size and a carry gun, but those are fantastic guns, good trigger, good sights. Those SIG P210s, They kind of fly under the radar. People forget about them. But if you want a really good upscale, fantastic shooting 9mm, that'd be a hard one to beat. And this really kind of depends, right? What's your use case? Is it something you carry day-to-day? A lot of people don't carry a full-size gun. I would encourage you to. I do, and I would encourage you to carry a full-size gun most of the time. That said, I know a lot of people don't. I carry it all the time. Again, my number one pick for this would be the 226. It's a very good shooting gun. It is also very rugged and reliable. Very forgiving of neglect and dirt and those kind of things. And still fantastically shootable. The 1911 I mentioned, the Colt Gold Cup and the 2011s. If you're a tinkerer, you like to hand-tune stuff, you like to do trigger work, you don't mind doing a little bit of extra maintenance, those would be a very good pick. Obviously, there's a lot of aftermarket for 2011s and 1911s, but you got to know what you're doing. It's not just like a Glock where you put in a new extractor. They often have to be tuned and fitted. If that's something you like to do, the 1911 is a good one for that. If you're leaning more towards just going to the range and shooting really tiny groups, which is a thing you mentioned, just at the range, that Colt Gold Cup again and the SIG P210 are really going to be good guns. And of course, always good advice, try these out if you can. A lot of these, you know, you go to a rental gun place, which is fantastic to go to. A lot of them are going to have your Glocks and your M&Ps, and those are all good guns, but they're probably not going to have a lot of these higher-end guns. Could be wrong. But it's still a good advice, right? If they have a, you know, a beater range 1911 and you like shooting the 1911, you're like, I'd like this, but a little bit nicer, a little bit fancier, then that'll lean you in one direction. Sounds like you've been shooting for a while and you probably know what you like and don't like. I hope this was helpful. Thanks, Jack. Love to hear any suggestions that you have. Thanks, TSP, and have a blessed day.
So I'll let the recommendations stand for themselves, because some of those guns I know of and I completely agree with, and honestly, I'm not the super tactical guy I think some people think I am. I'm much more impressed by like a pre-64 Winchester or a really nice lever action than I am like a super badass fighting pistol or whatever. I mean, I'm a 1911 guy. I've been shooting them since I was a kid. I've got really good ones. I've got mid-grade ones. I've got like Rock Island arms. Like, that's what I shoot, so I'm comfortable there, and I'm comfortable with his recommendations. The only thing I'll take, and it's not really exception to, because it's a matter of an opinion here, but the opinion isn't always true, even if it's often true. And that was where he said, the guy said, but I shot my friend's gun, and I shot better with it, and his response was, of course you did, because it's a better gun. Here's the story of the like business leadership speaker. Again, I can't remember who it was or what it was about, but he was talking about this phenomenon in all types of things in life. And he said it's like when you have to, you're going to go and you're going to play a sport with work, because it was like, you know, a work thing, like golf or tennis or something. And you don't have your clubs or your racket, so you borrow your friends and you play better than you ever played. He said, is that because that was a better brand racket or a better quality set of clubs? And he said, well, it can be. But often this is a dynamic at play. Because you were in this state of like, but it's borrowed. I don't have ever shot it before. And you're kind of relaxed. Sometimes it'll, by being relaxed, you'll actually perform better. That was, and his whole speech was about learning how to get into kind of the zone, the relaxed state. I remember enough about it to know that's where he was going with this. And I didn't remember that till I just said this. So who knows, maybe tonight in a dream it'll come back to me what the whole thing was about, and maybe I'll talk about it in the future, maybe not. But that was the point, that because you gave yourself permission to be bad, you actually ended up being better. And I think that can have an impact with guns as well. You pick up a gun, there's no reasonable expectation that you'll shoot it well, so you relax, and when you relax, you actually revert to all the training and muscle memory you have, and you actually perform better. Or there's also always this dynamic. I have bowled a 300 game. I just didn't do it in one game. What? Okay, what I mean by that is, I bowled one time in my life, enough strikes in a row to make a 300 game. But it started about the fourth frame of one game and ran into the next game. So it didn't count. But for, you know, whatever it was, like 12 frames or whatever, I couldn't miss. I could have been, if I could have stayed that way, the wealthiest, I don't know how much bowling people make, but I'm sure the best ones make millions of dollars. I could have been that guy, but then it went away and it never came back. And so there also is the fact, I've had that with darts. I've had a couple times in my life where I'm throwing a dart and that dart hits the board like it came out of a freaking nail gun and I can't miss. And three rounds later, I'm retarded again and I can barely hit the board. So just be careful, because you use somebody's thing and it worked out really good at that time, doesn't mean that it will continue to do that for you. So if you want the nice gun because it's a nice gun, great, but don't get confused by that in all walks of life, not just guns. All right, with that in mind, let's go ahead. I have a question now. I thought this is a great one. It's tax time, and there are some things that we just can't, we can't really fix now if we didn't know about them then, if that makes sense. And this came in for John Pugliano, but John is not the guy to answer the question. If I was going to defer this to an expert, since it does have to do with taxes, it would probably be more likely I would send it to Matt Sersley. But John knows some about Bitcoin, knows a lot about investing, but this is a question I think I can do a better job answering than anybody on the council. Tabitha says, I have a question for you or John Pugliano. Bitcoin and taxes with cold storage. How can you trace a specific coin for tax purposes, loss harvesting, or gain when you move them off an exchange into cold storage like a Trezor or any of the others that Jack recommends? Google has ads for companies that will look at your storage and do taxes, but that seems like a bad idea if you're generating a new address every time you send it off exchange. Maybe you shouldn't be doing that at this point. We'll get to it in a second. Or if you didn't know what you were doing and transferred it to different wallets until finding one that you liked. Thank you, Tabitha. Okay, so here's the reality of this. And there's some changes that are being made this tax year with forms. When you sell crypto on an exchange, they're going to assign a basis to it, and you're going to have to be in contention with that basis and declare it some other way if they say it's zero, which is ridiculous because it could never be zero. Right? There's no way you bought something for zero. I guess you could have received it, but then it will still have a basis because you should have paid taxes at the value it was when you received it. So there's always a basis. So I'm not sure exactly. We had another question about that. Matt Sersley handled that. That's going to be an interesting thing to see how it plays out as it goes. I have a feeling that companies like Coinbase and Binance and stuff, when you have currency off the exchange, move it on the exchange, and then sell it, the way they're going to handle this, instead of saying the basis is zero, it will say something like undetermined, and then it will fall on you to declare your basis. Here's the thing. Unless there is a legitimate basis declared on a statement, it is always up to you to declare your basis. And it is often the case that very old investments, it's impossible to be 100% sure you're right. So it's also impossible for the government to be 100% sure that you're wrong, but the burden of proof will fall on you. So you have to be careful with what I'm about to say. In general, what you're going to do is your best estimation at the value it was when you acquired it. And sometimes when you sell any asset and it goes on your taxes, or short and long-term gains, and they'll say when it was acquired and when it was dispensed, and that will determine how long you held it and what type of gain you're paying on it. Because short-term cap gains are higher than long-term cap gains. Okay? Now, if I had a bunch of Bitcoin in multiple addresses, and I was combining it all together, and I bought it over a period of years, there's really no one answer to this. The best that I can do is do my best estimate based on my own records. I bought XYZ, DP, QRZ across this time period at this amount, and that gives me an average price of X, and I put that in as my basis. Okay? By the letter of the law, unless it changed to BBB, and I'm unaware of it changing, I don't think it did, there are two things you can do with your Bitcoin. One is first in, first out, okay? And the other is by what's called UTXO. This is where your whole thing about a different address each time. I know that we all All of us influencers gave that advice at one time. And about 6 to 7 years ago, as the cost of transactions went up, based on UTXO utilization, we stopped saying it. But a lot of people that come into the industry keep saying it. They go watch videos from 20 years ago, 15 years ago, whatever, and then they repeat what was in those videos as though it's today's doctrine. And the reality is that I don't want a UTXO today, which means a single transaction moved money onto an address. At that time, no matter how many UTXOs it came from, right, it all gets combined into a single UTXO. In that transaction, I don't want anything right now with less than about 2 million Satoshis. A million absolute minimum. And generally what I do is I withdraw from exchange, I withdraw at a million. When I get to a million sats on any given, like whether it's an exchange, like Strike, or whether it's a rewards program like Fold. And then I don't, and that goes into my software wallet, okay? And then it will be at least 3 million sats on the software wallet side. Not your self-custody, but you're not using the hardware wallet like a Ledger or a Cold Card or a Trezor or something. The reason I stumbled there for a second, I do not recommend Ledger anymore based on some shit they've done. It's just from my archives I brought that up. So, I you know, a Treasure Model T, a Cold Card, whatever. When you have your money in a software wallet, usually you have a software wallet and you attach it to a hardware wallet, like pairing up Exodus with a Trezor. They work seamlessly with each other. And only when I have about 3 million on the software side, it's not yet in cold storage, it's in a software wallet, self-custody, when I have an accumulated group of transactions there of at least 3 million Satoshis, I will move that over to the hardware wallet in a single transaction, thereby combining them into one UTXO. You can now look at that UTXO and say, if it comes out of there, this is its basis, because you know where it all came from, and then you track each UTXO. Now, most of you will not be in a position where you are running a sophisticated software wallet with your hardware wallet, and I don't say things like use Zeus because I'm not your customer service provider. And if you want to do that, I think it's a great thing. When you do that, you can literally choose from which UTXO you send. That is ideal. Otherwise, it is better to simply know what you have on each wallet. And what you do is you have to set your own limit. Maybe it's $10,000. Maybe it's $100,000. I don't know what it is for you, and I can't tell you, so don't ask me. And each time you move to a hardware wallet, you figure out the aggregate average basis of every single thing on that wallet, and that becomes your basis for that wallet. You document that, and you start a new hardware wallet. You can use the same software wallet. Attach a different, and that way at least all your hardware wallets, let's say you have five of them, each one of those has Bitcoin only bought within a or acquired within a specific time frame that has an aggregate average basis, and you use that. Is that fully complying with the law as written and the code as written? Honestly, you get into a point, and a tax attorney probably never tell you this because their license is on the line if one thing is wrong. But where you get into your best attempt to comply is good enough. And I'll put it to you this way. I have traded stocks and commodities since I was in my 20s. I am now in my 50s. I have never hidden any of those trades from the federal government ever because doing so is dumb and eventually you will get caught. Okay? I have always declared a basis. I have had letters of demand, which are not actual audits from the IRS, inside companies, not personally, but inside companies. I have been through two audits from the IRS. I have never had a basis challenged. I'm not saying I'll never have. I'm just saying I never have. And in general, what you're trying to do is comply. And there are points at which thou cannot comply. You cannot be sure. And most people in the Bitcoin and crypto space that have been holding currency for 10 years now, there's at least some of it they really don't know where it's from, when it's from, how they got it. What they, and all you can do is kind of look at the time frame and declare a basis to the best of your ability. That's it. And try to declare a basis that makes so much sense that it's difficult to challenge. In other words, if you know you bought it in 2015, don't look up the all-time high from 2015 and call it that. Unless you absolutely have a transaction record that says you're a dumbass and you bought it on that day. And you bought all of it on that day. Going forward, you need to be keeping better records here. And this is a good opportunity, since most people are going to be long-term holders, to begin that process of all the ancient Bitcoin, which is anything before you started doing this back, leave it where it is, combine it into good UTXOs, figure out the best numbers you can for it, and all Bitcoin going forward move into a new hardware wallet system, and then once a year or once every 2 years, kind of put that one and to the side and start another one, or at some dollar amount, start another one. Now, if you're a person who holds on exchange, which I don't advise, but if that's what you're going to do, the good news is if you hold on the same exchange you buy it on, they'll do all that for you. And for a lot of people that are now trading in the world of ETFs, it'll work like any other 1099K that comes out of your... It's not a 1099K now, I don't remember what it's called, but it'll work out the same way it would for any other stock, commodity, fund, ETF you were holding. And so it won't be that big of a deal. There are going to be people that are going to find out they have incredibly large tax bills on early acquired Bitcoin. You know, if you bought it for $600 and you're selling it for even $70,000, it's almost all income. And this is where it's going to lead to a lot more of the program where people are going to follow the Saylor model, which is, why would I sell it anyway when I can borrow against it? If I acquired enough to do like a 3% loan-to-value loan scheme across my retirement, I can die and never spend any of it. And then my heirs can either close it out or continue the program if it works for them. The beauty of that will be they will lock in the value of the Bitcoin at the time that they inherit it. And all of this, so if you're leaving this to your heirs, unless you're 50 or older, right, even 45 or older, I would say at this point, and you have a long-term plan with this, that's the good news, that when you pass on and you leave it behind, the value at the time that they inherit it will lock in their base. And it'll make their lives a lot easier. This is what happens when government drags its feet. They've created... This is why I think what you're going to see is somebody somewhere will get called out on this that has enough resources to fight it. And the government's going to learn through the court system that there is a standard that they even have to live by with the courts, and that is... You cannot require compliance to something that the person cannot possibly comply to. And IRS agents, by the way, that conduct audits, they are judged on their success ratio of pursuing audits, and they're going to tend toward choosing audits that look like they can actually get some money out of it, that they can actually win. What you're more likely to get in this situation is a letter of demand or a letter requesting additional documentation. And so I would say the best time to have done this would have been from day one. None of us did that were involved in like 2012, where there was no tax guidance whatsoever at that point. And what would be the smartest thing the government could do with this is at some point to have a declare and lock that you could say, this is how much I'm holding. This is roughly, this is my best guess at a basis. And you would submit that. And all of that Bitcoin from that point, like an amnesty point, backward, unless they took contention with it then, which would be, we don't believe you, so you didn't commit a crime yet, because you didn't owe any taxes on it. This would be just a declaration that at that point that could be settled, and then going forward, any of it at exchange would revert to that basis. And if they're smart, they'll do that, and they're not smart, so they probably won't, and it'll probably be a de facto what I said. I know that's not the answer anybody wanted to hear, But it's the truth that there is a point where, how long have you held, like, before, you got to understand, even stocks and stuff, like brokerage accounts, it used to be, they didn't send you anything. They just sent the government and said, this guy sold X amount of stock. That's all they did. And the government would find out you sold stock, and if you forgot to report it, they would say you owe, like if you sold $30,000 worth of Ford Motor Company stock, they'd say you made $30,000. Because I got one of those on a small trade of like $2,500 on a small microcap stock, and they wanted it all, and I was like, no, and we went back and we paid the fine. And by the way, we still, I mean, it wasn't that big a deal. The only thing that usually happens here is you have to give them money that you didn't give them up front. The fines and the penalties are how they make it hurt enough that you don't always think that way. But even with that, if you're not trying to screw the system back, if you're trying to comply, the amount, it's generally worth still being aggressive with your taxes and your deductions. Best I can do on that one. But going forward, it makes good sense. And it's not the first time I said to start kind of parking your self-custody in at least maybe once a year or once every other year. It's all from that all that year of acquisition. Because it's going to be very difficult for them ever to say, if you hold any Bitcoin at all, you have to sell the first Bitcoin you bought first. When you can, the one beautiful thing about a public ledger, you can definitively prove, well, that's not where this is from. And it doesn't work that way with anything else. If I go out and buy silver every year, I can choose which coins I sell. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. I appreciate everybody for tuning in today. I want to remind you guys I am going to be teaching and speaking at Living Free in Tennessee in April this year. I don't know how many tickets Nicole has left for that, but last night I think she had 3 or 5 or something like that. I shared it on Facebook. So if you want to come to that event, the opportunity is, the door is closing, and I would take her up on it and come meet me and Alan Booker and Sandor Katz and Nicole Sauce and just a ton of other really, really great people. With that, I hope you guys have a great weekend. I'll catch you on Monday, and we'll start a whole new week off together.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. The revolution.